Today is the 9th of December, 2015. This is David Caruso. I'm here with Roger Early Pryor. We're interviewing Dr. Martin Karplus for an oral history interview at his office at Harvard University. Thank you again for agreeing to take the time to sit down with us. As Roger mentioned, you know, we want to start at the very beginning, so we'd like to hear a little bit about, we know that you were born in Vienna, Austria, in October of 1930.
Actually, I was born in March 15, 1930, which plays a role. We came to the U.S. in October of 1938. Maybe that's what...
A little confusion there. Okay.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit about your early life, your family, what your parents did, grandparents did in Austria?
Well, maybe beginning with my grandparents. On my mother's and my father's side, actually, both of them were physicians. They, on my mother's side, they came from Odessa to Austria, and on my father's side, they came from what used to be Czechoslovakia, a small town where there are still people with the same name actually living there. And my grandfather on my mother's side came to Vienna from Odessa at the time, which was a big port in Russia. It was one of the biggest ports, and his family had handled export-import there for the Russians. And at various times there were pogroms that occurred there. And it was actually just before one of them, that they became aware. It was at the time of the battleship Potemkin revolt, that they managed to leave very shortly before anything happened. So he and his family, actually, there were, I think, 13 living children, which was very unusual for those days, that they, I think, two died and all the rest survived. And, it was a wealthy Jewish family, which was, completely accepted at that time, though there were these pogroms at various times. And they managed to leave, most of them, and come to Vienna. And in a way, they sort of left just before something happened, the way I left Vienna, again, just before things really got very bad for Jews. And so he came to Vienna and finished his medical studies at the University of Vienna. I don't know whether you want me to go this much
sure.
detail.
Yes, please.
At the University of Vienna. And then began working at a clinic, a private clinic, which he took over after a number of years, and that was called the Fungo Heilanstalt, and it basically dealt with rheumatic diseases and used a radioactive mud, which was called fungo. It was actually, I knew that it was called the fungo and that they used this, but I didn't realize that the word was actually Italian and just meant mud. And so he took this over, and my two of their children, actually, my mother worked there as a dietitian, and one of my aunts, who was a physician, worked there as a sort of in-house physician. And then there was another daughter, Claire, and a brother, Alex, who actually studied chemistry. And so there was this, intellectual atmosphere. I mean, there were there was a sister, Eugenie Goldstern, who was became a relatively famous ethnologist and was one of the few close members of my family who were deported and died in one of the concentration camps. My uncle Alex, actually, when the Nazis came in, he was put into a concentration camp, and somebody came to my grandfather and said, look, if you sign the Fungo over to me, one of the Nazis, we'll release him. And my grandfather did, of course, and was signed over, and fortunately, whoever the person was, I don't know his name, kept his word. The only thing he said was, well, your uncle has to leave Austria within a week or something, which made it impossible for him to get a visa to come to the United States, which was rather complicated. And so he went to New Zealand, where he lived during the war. And then he came back after the war, they got the Fungo back, and he administered it until he died. Then it became part of the Viennese hospital system, and it still exists and it still functions, and I visited recently. As an aside, somebody's actually making a film about me, about my life. And so we went there and visited it. And so anyway, my other grandfather was a professor of neurology at the University of Vienna. And he's well known for discovering the function of the hypothalamus, and which where he did these experiments in which he took a cat and anesthetized it and then sort of removed all the nerves that came out of the hypothalamus and observed, and he stimulated it, the cat still reacted with its eyes either open or closed, I don't remember which. And so he deduced that it wasn't a nervous excitation from the nervous system, but rather that it was some sort of fluid that did this. And more recently people have studied this, and apparently the hypothalamus is the only part of the brain that actually has cells that can synthesize hormones, and confirming, everything he found. And his wife, Valerie Karplis, came from the Lieben family, which was a very well-known family in Vienna. And one of her cousins, I think, I would have to check, Robert von Lieben, is actually the person who invented the diode according to European standards. Here it's Lee DeForest who invented it, and there was actually a long patent fight which the family lost, but they were still relatively well off on both sides when we lived there. And he's on a postage, Austrian postage stamp, and one of the Liebens, Anna, was actually one of Freud's first patients, and because many intelligent women were not allowed to do anything, so they became neurotic, which isn't surprising. And maybe that's enough of this sort of, there are lots of things to be able to say.
Do you know what brought your grandparents to Austria to begin with? You mentioned that they were fleeing, but why Austria?
Well, Austria was very close. It was, of course, this was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, mm-hmm. of which much of this area was part at the time. And it was a place where Jews were accepted at the time. And Vienna was, of course, it had 2 million people. It was a major capital of a very large empire. And it was just the area where there was, a lot of intellectual fervent there. I mean, one can go through all the people who lived there in the late 1800s, early 1900s, when this all happened. So it was in Vienna. The medical school was known to be a very good school. And so it was just, I think it was the attraction of having, they had to leave. And it was also very close. I mean, it was really just going across the border to get to Vienna, so that was easy to get there. As far as my paternal grandfather's side is concerned, I don't know exactly why they left Czechoslovakia. And I'm still looking into this in terms of, I am writing, so there's a film being made about me, which this is an aside. In addition, I'm trying to flesh the Spinach article into an autobiography. And so I'm looking up all these things. And so one of the reasons I accepted to do this, to be honest, is I thought it would be helpful have this opportunity and get some insight, in terms of what was of interest to you. Mm-hmm. So the answer is I don't yet know. Okay. I hope to know. I know where they live. I know there's still parts of the family there, but I don't know.
How did those two sides of the family come together? How did your mother and father meet?
Well, the sort of relatively wealthy intellectual families. It was a relatively small group, and they were interacting. And actually, both of them, my mother and father, went to study physics at the University of Vienna. Although she also worked as a dietitian, and they both stopped their studies. I think it was partly because we were very well off, and there wasn't sort of any pressure to do anything. And I'm not absolutely sure whether they met actually when they were students, but there are large families, others of them, and cousins and such were related, so they met one way or another. It's an interesting question, but I don't know the answer. Yeah.
How long after they met did you and your brother arrive?
Well, after they were married, it was, when my brother was born in 27 and I was born in 1930, and the exact date, they hadn't been married all that long, but I think that, again, that's a good question to which I should know the answer and can find it out. I mean,
so do you have other siblings aside from you and Robert?
No, they're just the two of us.
The two brothers?
And he died a few years ago he was actually jogging in Central Park. He was visiting New York. He was a professor at Berkeley. And he had a heart attack, and then I guess he wasn't found soon enough that he lost blood to his brain. And so he never really recovered, and then lived for a number of years. And I would visit him regularly, and he was making a very great effort to sort of recover. But on the other hand, he realized in some sense that he had lost what he had been, which was, an outstanding physicist. And he was very angry often that, he just didn't have this anymore. But, I don't know how much of this wants to put in there, but anyway.
Maybe we can revisit that as we get through. I'm interested in your experiences as a young child with all these family members, these aunts and uncles, from especially from the Goldstern side of the family. Mm-hmm. What was it like being a child with having so much family around? Was that the case?
It was wonderful. I mean, and I think, you know, we used to get together while we were in Vienna. We used to, for various holidays, and with, you know, in Vienna, we'd celebrate them together. We were what is often called Christmas tree Jews, which meant that we actually had a Christmas tree, Tannenbaumhütten, and so, you know, we'd get together for that, and often on weekends we would be invited to mainly my maternal grandparents' side, the hospital where they actually lived in the hospital, and they'd have all kinds of wonderful pastries and such, Rennie's pastries being well known, and so it was really a very warm atmosphere. One thing of interest, I mentioned my aunt, who was an ethnologist, and she was very much interested in children's toys, and so she would always be there, and she lived also in the Fungo. She never married, and bring these toys down and sort of observe us as we played with them. And then, in the summers, every summer we would go in large family groups on vacation, either on some of the lakes in Austria, or one time we went to Adria, in Italy, always where there was water, because everybody liked to swim or go out in boats and such. So I think it was very important for me, particularly, when we had to leave because of the Nazis, that I'd had this background of really having a wonderful circle of people, supportive people, and, so.
Did your mother or father work while in Austria?
Yes, I mean, my mother, after they stopped going to school, my mother worked as a dietitian in the Fungo, and my father was mainly involved in banking, because particularly on my grandmother's side, the Lieben family, they had large holdings and such, so he mainly was involved in that.
You mentioned, there are two things I'm curious about. Your paternal grandfather, clearly he was doing medical research. Was he also an active practicing physician?
I don't think so, actually. I think he was, a professor. He was teaching, but he wasn't a clinical professor. I mean, I'm not absolutely sure of that, but I think that he was mainly doing research and teaching at the University of Vienna, mm-hmm. which, why were they both doctors to a certain extent? At least my maternal grandfather, Uncle Samorla, as we used to call him, who, according to the people he worked for, was rather somewhat of a tyrant, but as far as we were concerned, he was this wonderful grandfather, had started to study medicine in Odessa and then finished his studies. And what I started to say was that being a doctor or a lawyer, some of the professions that were open to Jews, while many other professions weren't open to Jews. So whether that influenced them, I don't really know, but I think it was an important point in what happened.
Part of the reason I asked is I'm also curious to know whether or not your grandparents exposed you to any form of science when you were a child. Did you get to go into a lab with your grandfather, or did you go through the Fungo when you were visiting family and see things that were going on? I was just wondering about exposure.
Yeah, well, I think the answer is No, in the general sense. Mm-hmm. Though, as I think I mentioned in here, that there was a tradition, particularly on my mother's side, that somebody would become a physician for going back quite a few years. And so when I was the only one, unlike my brother and my various cousins, who showed any interest in medicine. And as I think I wrote in there, is that I used to go around bandaging chairs and such. But that wasn't really that I was exposed to that. I mean, I did have this uncle, Paul Wermer, who was a very good clinician. And his wife was a dentist, and I would visit them, and sometimes he would talk to me about medicine and such. I mean, that, and you know, and this continued later on when they came to the, also they managed to come to the United States, and they lived in New York, and I would visit with them, and he, you know, he would talk to me about the sort of exciting new things that they'd learned and such. You know, when I was still in junior high school and high school, yeah.
The being born Jewish and having this history of fleeing multiple occasions, I'm wondering the importance of the Jewish religion versus the Jewish culture in your family. Was Sabbath something in the High Holy Days, attending, was that Noah's not a part?
No, I mean, it was... I mean, there was a certain pride in being Jewish, but it was secular Judaism. We never, I mean, the first time I ever was in a Jewish temple was in the United States when I was invited after winning, I think, the Westinghouse scholarship to give a lecture there. And I don't think, as I remember, my lecture was something about, is there a God? And so so I was never invited again. Well, that's true. I think that's correct. That I never. Yeah.
You've written about a nanny that you were fond of. Can you tell us a little about her? And her name was
Mitzi.
Mitzi.
Yeah, Mitzi, and I'm most children, particularly because both my parents worked, had a nanny in those days, and so I spent a lot of time with her, and we would play together, and there was sort of that on the weekend my mother would play with us, but during the rest of the week we mainly either went to kindergarten or something, or played with her. And I mean, she was not at all intellectual or anything. It was just a warm, supportive feeling that was part, if you like, of the large family. Our Mitzi, we didn't know after the war, but the one who was the equivalent for my cousins, Gus and George, who were the children of Lene, who was a physician, the aunt, became a psychiatrist when she came to the U.S. I mean, she continued contact after the war, and we obviously tried to help her and such. It was not what happened to my Mitzi or our one. I don't really know. I don't think we had any contact with her after the war. Yeah.
Was she involved in both your and Robert's young childhood?
Yeah. So she was with our family for a long time and was sort of another element of living in an environment where, I was always felt at home, which, I think played a very important role in then sort of losing everything when we came to the U.S.
When the Nazis came through in 1938, during the Anschluss, was before that time, was there a sense of rising anti-Semitism in this cosmopolitan Vienna that you remember as a child?
Yes, I mean, I didn't personally realize something until it became very, well, it was before Hitler came in, or was welcomed in, and my parents had this awareness, and my aunt, Clara, who was the youngest one, had been to England and had learned English, and so she gave my brother and me English lessons. And so my parents, I think, were already thinking about the need to leave and that something would come up. And we also found that at a certain stage, it was fairly late. I mean, it was probably just in 38 that things like that a teacher that I had had here, I don't know exactly what happened with my brother, but a teacher I had had who was Jewish. He was a very good teacher and also was very popular because his wife had a candy store, so whenever people did well, he would give them rewards. And the parents had gotten together, this was when I was in first grade, they'd gotten together and suggested that they would like him to continue, basically, that he would teach the next grade to us, which he did. But then before Hitler actually came in, he was dismissed. Then we got another teacher who was very anti-Semitic, and so finally my parents took me out of school, and they worked with me at home. But that wasn't a very long period, but that was sort of one sign. The other sign was that we lived what was at that time the edge of Vienna, and very close to us there was the I don't know quite what it would be called. It was a place where the streetcars ended, and where store and there were two brothers who were the same age as I was and my brother was, were sort of our best friends, really, and they were not Jewish, and they were children of somebody who worked there. At a certain stage, again, it was not very long, but maybe in 37 or something, they stopped playing with us and called us dirty Jews and such, and we didn't really understand, why this happened, but we were very upset by it. And
do you remember speaking with your parents about that and asking them, or talking with Mitzi about that?
I don't really remember. It's very likely that I did, but I don't really remember. Yeah.
Were your parents, how were your parents in your eyes as a child, in your memories, responding to some of these transitions? Were they protective of you,
they tried, to somehow have us believe that nothing was really going on and that everything would be all right. And but they had also prepared a reservation in Zurich, where at a pension, and gotten me a passport, which I still have somewhere. With the idea that we would leave Austria very shortly, and made train reservations, and basically, we left 3 days after Hitler came into Austria, and that all of this had been prepared, so this was going on, but is not quite correct that my father was not allowed to leave because the Nazis, Austrian Nazis in many ways were worse than the German Nazis, at least in the early days, and like there's this story that my grandfather, who had the fungo, had to come out, and people had written things on the sidewalk about Jews, and he had to get down on his hands and knees and wash this all off, and various degrading experiences. It's not absolutely sure. My cousin Gus, who is a year older than my brother, thinks he knows that this is true, but it's not absolutely sure. But there had been all these things going on, but in terms of my knowing about it, I think my parents were very protective, and as I started to say, even though we had prepared to leave as a family together, my father was not allowed to leave, and he was actually thrown into jail in Vienna. And thanks to the Nobel Prize, one of the ministers of the Austrian government stopped in to see me, and so he sort of asked offhand, well, what can we do for you? And I said, well, I would be very interested to find out exactly what happened with my father when he was in jail in Vienna. And like good Germans, there was a detailed record of every transaction that had happened, how he had signed over our house, who had signed. We had a little car called the Steyr Baby, which also plays a role in my story. And, just everything was recorded, and it was basically only when he had signed over everything that he was allowed to get out of prison. Now, I know that my uncle Edu, who was already in the U.S. and worked for General Radio and invented the Variac, had gotten the head of the company, Mr. Easton, to give us an affidavit. And as you may or may not know, to come to the U.S. at that time, you had to have somebody who guaranteed that you wouldn't become a ward of the state or something like that. And he guaranteed this and wrote this. And then, once we were in Switzerland, we had to basically wait for our visa, and it wasn't clear whether my father would get out of jail or not. And the one part of the record that isn't complete is that my uncle Edu gave $5,000 to somebody in the jail, which was instrumental in letting my father get out. Now, that isn't recorded anywhere. So who got that money, we don't really know. But anyway, he was able to get out. And then when we finally got a visa and then booked passage to the U.S., miraculously, almost, my father joined us, and we came to the U.S. together. And so, this is really answering your question that, my mother always said, well, we will go to the U.S. together and such. And in my memory, all the experience in Switzerland, and then we spent the summer before we finally got passage to go to the U.S. in October, I remember all this as being, a wonderful time in our life, and that I wasn't aware of that my mother must certainly have been terribly anxious about what would happen to my father and such. Now, Marcy thinks that I must have had some awareness of this, but in terms of what I remember, it was, we had a fun time, the school we went to in Switzerland, and my brother and I learned Switzerdeutsch, which is relatively hard to understand, and when we when we were at home, if we didn't want my mother to understand, we would speak that and such. So I have all these good memories, and whether I was somehow aware of this or I don't really know. But,
so you didn't witness your father being arrested, you just knew?
No, he just couldn't come with us, and so I knew he was in jail, but and you know, when he, I mean, one of his attributes, which I think played a very important role in my life, was that he always had a positive view of everything that happened. And when he joined us, I mean, he described how he had taught his jailers to play chess and had chess competitions. And it was true of everything that he did, that he found interesting, positive things, and that I think has played a big role in my life, that I've sort of been able to, when there were problems or whatever, to surmount them. I think that's sort of, I mean, I sort of go on, but yeah.
Do you have memories of or understanding of what happened to some of this extended family? All of these aunts and uncles and cousins that were on the Goldstern side or from the Karpla side that you knew from as children?
Well, I think we were very, very lucky. And except for my great aunt, who was an ethnologist, who stayed in Vienna partly to take care of one of her brothers who was quite ill. And then one day went walking and disappeared. I mean, that's all we know. And then we know where she was killed in Sobibor, in the concentration camp there. And there's a whole story connected with that, but I don't think it's really germane. I mean, she...
When around the time did you have a sense of what had happened? When was it at a point where you became older, where your parents told you a little bit more about what you had really gone through?
That was really when after we arrived in the U.S. and so it was probably 1940 or so, when 40-41, when we moved to Newton, and there was this business that, we bought this house in Newton, and a small house, which actually the person who bought it from my brother and me, after my parents had died, and is still living there. I didn't really know this, but then I gave a talk at BU to some students, that one of my former students asked me to give a talk there, and one of the things I've done with the Nobel Prize is to give talks to sort of groups of disadvantaged students to try to inspire them in terms of science. And there somebody came up to me and told me, well, I'm the person who bought the house from your parents, and we're still living there, and invited us to visit it. And when we were there filming this story, they unfortunately weren't home, but we were the, as I know now, probably the first Jewish family in Newton, even though now it's one of the places where many Jewish families live. It has a whole Jewish culture and such. And our neighbor, I guess the story is that one day an FBI person came to our house and very apologetically said, look, your neighbor has told us that every morning before you go off to work, you sort of face the house and do Heil Hitler. And this was our next door neighbor, and And he said, the FBI agent said, well, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me, but, you know, being during the war and everything, you know,
refugees.
I have to investigate this.
Wow.
And so that was one of the, you know, we asked sort of when I became awareness of things. And then, you know, my parents, you know, talked about, you know, leaving and how lucky we were in many ways. And really, our immediate family, except for my aunt, managed to get out, and at least all the other cousins and such, and some, and most of them to the United States, except my uncle who went to New Zealand. Yeah.
Did they all come to Boston, or did they
go to some, some came to Boston, and some to mainly Boston and New York.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty much, and so that we kept the close relationship, you know, with them.
And why was it that Boston became the American hub on the trip from England to the United States?
I mean, we landed in New York and then came to Boston, and I don't exactly know. I mean, Boston did have, you know, have sort of a refugee house. It was a large mansion where we were, you know, taught what it was like to be an American and such. And so that was one of the reasons that we personally came here, because my uncle, who was working at General Radio, was here, and he had sort of found an apartment for us. And but there were a large group of Jewish families in Boston. I think that, you know, Boston, many people had relatives who already were here and came here, and so, you know, more so I think than Philadelphia or Washington or further south. And, you know.
What are some of your memories of that mansion that was the acculturation training? What was that like?
Well, other than that, it was sort of a big mansion, and I think we were able to stay there for several weeks until we actually had an apartment that our uncle had tried to find. Well, it wasn't that different in some ways of the mansions that my family had in Austria. I mean, there were relatives. I don't know the exact relationship, but I mean, we called many people aunts, even though they weren't really aunts. You know, they were second cousins on time removed, but the aunts were sort of the, and one, the Motoshitsky family, which was another wealthy Austrian family, had a big house in the countryside where we would go sometime for the weekend and visit, and she was actually the mother of Lisa Marie-Louise Motoshitsky, who became a famous artist in England, lived in England for many years. And so we have quite a few artists in our family, but again, that's an aside. I mean, so that the house sort of reminded me of this sort of country house, even though it was in Brighton, I think. It was on the hilltop, and people were very welcoming, and of course, my brother and I probably knew more English than our parents, but that was sort of a special thing that we already had a connection, and it was a nice idea, like all these experiences we had living in Zurich, and then in the summer and the beach in La Bola. It was, again, I have this positive view of things. Mm-hmm. Again, Marcy accuses me of forgetting the negative parts. And it may be true, but it was nice, and then we found this apartment and moved in there, and I went, you know, to school immediately, and my brother did too, and we had this feeling that we very much wanted to be, you know, real Americans. I mean, we wanted to belong. And at home for a while, we would, again, my brother and I would mainly speak in English, which, I mean, our parents knew enough so that they, we could talk to them in English, but we tried to sort of not talk German to them and such, which I got over after a while, but there was...
Was that resistance? Was that part of being a rebellious young lad? Or was that a part of your trying to help your parents adjust as well?
Well, I would say neither, in a way. It was just that I wanted to belong to the U.S. and wanted to be, you know, and I used to play with the other children and such. I mean, just try to really play. I remember playing marbles on the sidewalk and things like that. And also this incident where I was running around with them and was, quote, run over by a car. And, on the, and well, I wasn't really run over by a car, but I was... I sort of slipped off the sidewalk, and the car came and actually stopped on my foot. And the guy got out and said, "Yo, what's wrong?" I said, "How would you get off my foot?" And then, which he did. But then the point of it is that he said, "Well, can I take, you know," he was very concerned, "can I take you home to your parents and such?" And I said, "No, no, no, I don't want them really to know about this." And so he finally went off. But so the fact that I was sort of, you know, associating with everybody around, I'm not sure that they were, you know, that happy about it. But anyway, so, but again, it was sort of the idea of belonging, which was, I think, played a very important role. And yeah.
What was it like for your family generally adjusting to a different financial circumstance in the United States? Clearly, they had to give up a lot in order to leave Austria. They are taking some of they're taking their knowledge, their skills with them. But just because you have those that knowledge and skill, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to become, you know, a well-paid physician. I think you mentioned that your aunt became a psychiatrist eventually.
Right.
So clearly, I mean, they were able to bring those skills and put them to use, but you don't it's not a guarantee that those are going to translate. How was it for your family?
Well, you know, speaking of my immediate family, I mean, we did have a certain amount of money, partly because my father had gotten quite a bit of money out by, he was always a stamp collector, and he had some very valuable stamps, or even bought some valuable stamps, and put them on envelopes, you know, though they were, may not have been valid anymore, and sent them to the United States. And then we also did have some money in the Netherlands, which we were able to get to the United States, which I just discovered recently. I have lots of papers around from my parents, and there they describe that in order to get my grandmother, on my mother's side, my grandfather died just about that time, and just, I don't know whether it was... because of the stress or everything, but nothing so special. He just passed away, and to get my grandmother to give her an affidavit, we had to show that we had some money, and so it turned out we, in the papers that I found, actually again in connection with making this film, went through all this, and it says that we did have a certain amount of money, and we were, for example, we were able, you know, not immediately, but after a couple of years, when it was time for me to go to junior high school, to buy the small house that I mentioned in Newton. We sold it for around $10,000 or whatever. You know, nowadays, it probably would at least be worth maybe 100 times as much, but probably not quite that. But anyway, and so we had some money, but again, you know, immediately my father took a course at the Wentworth Institute in machinery and such, and then found, because it was during the war, he very quickly found a job at a pump factory which made pumps for airplanes. Mm-hmm. And my mother went to school and got a degree as a dietitian, a master's degree, and worked at the Beth Israel Hospital. And when she was there for quite a few years, the food was much better than it ever had been. And I would go over there so often because I was interested also in the hospital. So they both, adapted to the fact that we weren't wealthy, but, we were reasonably, we didn't lack anything because my father did find this position very quickly and rose very quickly in the ranks. And again, just the way he described what happened when he was in jail, again, he would come home and tell us, what the interesting things, how these pumps worked, or that he'd found a new way of making the pumps and such. And was always this interesting description, both for me and my brother. I think my brother understood more of it, what was going on at the time. But there was still this sort of view. He found whatever he was doing, he found something interesting and positive about it. And that, I think, played a very important role.
Sometimes at that age, brothers can repel from one another and not want, and especially with an older brother and having a younger brother tagging along. What was your and Robert's relationship, having gone through these experiences and then moving and living in Massachusetts?
Well, I always did try to tag along, as you describe, and when we were, when we had first moved to Newton, my brother asked for it, but my parents gave him a chemistry set, and of course I wanted to play with it also, or do whatever he was doing. And he said, he told me, "Oh, you're too young to do this. You can't come around here." And I was very unhappy about that, of course. And my parents, thought that having two people with a chemistry set would be just too much, would be explosive, as I said in there. And so they gave me a microscope, which originally I was very unhappy about. But then it had the really nice attribute that my father, who was, he liked to observe nature, which I think had a lot of effect on me also. And I know I would go when he liked to go fishing, but not to fish, actually to catch fish, but just to watch the fish and such. And and this observing nature really is something that appealed to me. And having the microscope, he also, spent a lot of much more time with me, looking. I'd see something and in the microscope, and show it to him, and much more time with me than with my brother. I mean, he wasn't that interested in the chemistry, and so I think it had this very positive effect. And I still have the microscope. It's, there was this incident where I used to go out and just collect water flowing in the gutters and such. And one thing was, of course, when I brought that in, it made smells as bad as my brother's smells. But also, that one day I observed the rotifers, and that was, it was just, I showed it my father and my mother, and it was just wonderful little creatures, and also showed them to some of my friends, and in school they came over, and And so then, you know, I really was very excited about having the microscope. I think that part of it was that my father showed more interest in this than, you know, in what my brother was doing. And I think there was also some jealousy that I had that my father used to, you know, teach mathematics to my brother, and in the morning before getting up and going to school, there was sort of chatter on the weekend, and I would listen, but I didn't really understand what was going on. It was just beyond me, and so I was somewhat jealous. There was this jealousy. But I remember, I mean, this was somewhat later, you know, my brother being very supportive of me, and that played an important role. But there was some rivalry, and obviously the fact, like with my father and such, that I wanted to be able to do the same thing as he did, and there's just no way of my doing that because, you know, I was too young, you know, 3 years younger, so I was always somewhat behind, which I don't know whether it led to an inferiority complex or whatever, but, yeah.
Thinking about what you mentioned with regard to, you know, the friends that wouldn't play with you in Vienna, mm-hmm. because you became this dirty Jew, and also thinking about your neighbor who said that you were saluting Hitler in the mornings, I'm curious to know how you and your family were received generally when you were in Newton. Did anyone think of you as the Jewish family? Did anyone treat you differently because they knew that you came from Austria? You know, what was it like in terms of those aspects moving into this?
Well, I think we really didn't have that much relationship with people in Newton who weren't immigrants. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a large immigrant community in Boston, of which I don't think anybody lived in Newton at the time. I mean, I don't know whether we're really the first family, but it just wasn't the way it is nowadays. And so we didn't, you know, I mean, there was also no, I don't know whether if we had been not Jewish, whether we would have been invited by some neighbors. I don't think this was done that much at the time. And so our contact was with other immigrants, mainly Jewish, that, you know, many of whom we had known from Vienna. Mm-hmm. And there was a newspaper, a German newspaper, put out, and there was, you know, there was a big community life. Not, I mean, some people were more religious, some people were less religious. I mean, there was relatively, most of the people that I'm aware of weren't really religious. I mean, they had a Jewish heritage, which we've always been very proud of, but so it was really, you know, now what happened, if anything happened with my father, he never talked about it, and whether there was something like that where he had contact with, you know, with non-Jewish people when he was working, and I, you know, as soon as I could, I worked for a while at the equivalent of the Star Market. I don't remember what exactly its name was, but just, you know, when people had orders, putting the whatever had been ordered into boxes to have it delivered, and I was just one of the kids. I mean, I'm just trying to think about how much of an accent I had. I very quickly didn't have very much of an accent. And people tell me when I was talking on the phone to one of my relatives, they would know that I was talking to one of my relatives, or my brother, for example, because our accent would sort of mount up. Mm-hmm. But in normal conversation, I don't think it was really obvious to people who weren't sensitive to things. So I never felt it's, well, I mean, you asked my parents, and I think there it was mainly that they were in the Jewish community, and I don't think really felt anything, and they never mentioned anything from their work, and I really, I don't think it really had any sort of effect that even going on, you know, that, I mean, there were instances where the fact that I was Jewish had an effect on what might happen. I mean, the clearest case was that in the chemistry department in Illinois, where there had never been any Jewish hired because of Roger Adams, who ran it. I don't know whether he's somebody that probably didn't exist. But, well, he must have. He didn't. You don't have an oral history. Yeah. I mean, he was a well-known organic chemist. And he just, there were no Jews in the chemistry department. And then he retired, and Herbert Carter, who was an organic chemist, became the head of the department. And Illinois was one of the places where department heads were really department heads and did a lot of the hiring, rather than at Harvard, you know, where the department, whatever he's called now, maybe he's still called now a department head, but doesn't have that much power. I mean, he does a lot of the dirty work of doing everything, making things ring, but it's really the whole department that nowadays hires. So. And when he retired, then there were four, actually, Jewish faculty members who were hired in the same year, of which I was one. So that, you know, so in that sense, I guess that was one time where being Jewish had an effect and just happened to work out well, just to be at the right time. Mm. And that's, of course, much later in the story, how I got the job there and such. And
will you tell us a little bit about your summer memories in the United States? As a child, you'd gone to the mountains and to the beaches across Europe and Austria and Italy. What were summers like in the United States?
Well, I mean, that, again, thanks to my parents, in order to make summers nice for us, in the first summer they worked at, my father worked as a gardener and my mother worked as a cook with a family in Holderness, New Hampshire, which had a nice summer place, and there was, so we could be there during the summer. And another time they worked at a boys' camp, and again we were admitted to this camp, and so I mean they again did everything, you know, to make it possible for us to have a nice time. I mean, then shortly after that, you know, I joined the Boy Scouts and then went to and had done a lot of nature study. And actually, when I was quite young, I must have been, I don't know, 15 or 16, you know, I became nature counselor at one of these camps, and already independently of my parents. But the initial thing was that they, you know, they did everything to make our life, whether it's to say as close to what it had been in Austria may not be the right term, but just to give us a really nice summer, because they couldn't afford to send us to a camp or something like that. So that's a case where, you know, the limited income really played a role, but they did their best to make it a nice summer. And I remember these summers, you know, as really being wonderful summers and such.
Can you talk a little bit about the experience with the Boy Scouts?
Well, it's, I mean, I was a very active Boy Scout and accumulated merit badges. Of course, we haven't talked about my interest in birds yet. But you know, I got all kinds of nature merit badges, and then I think I became the youngest Eagle Scout in the history, at least of New England, I don't know, and such. And, you know, I enjoyed going and doing all the things, going on hikes with them and such, and something, going overnight. And
where were some of those trips? Do you remember?
Well, most of them were relatively local or in the area. I mean, with a scout troop in Newton, and I don't really remember sort of who was involved. None of the people that I interacted with became friends or such, but it was something. Well, again, I think it was partly belonging, doing something that was really, you know, Boy Scouts of America, you know. And at those times, I didn't know about all their prejudices and everything, and there were no problems, as far as I know, with homosexual interactions, and certainly nothing that affected me, though I did one time, it was, this is really, when I was at Cornell one summer, I was working with Don Griffin on bats and birds, and there some people befriended me, and you know, and then they said, well, why don't you come over to, I mean, they were a little bit older. I was in college. So I was, 17 or 8, something like that. And then we had nice conversations and anything, and then sort of ended up in the bedroom where they had a big bed. And, I mean, I was very innocent, I guess, yeah. But then finally I realized, you know, that I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And just got out. I mean, nothing at all happened. Mm-hmm. And then I also had when I was in Dudley House, it was already when it was, I think, the first year in Adams House. It was when I was in Dudley House. And there I had a roommate who was homosexual, but he had no interest in me. He just had some other people that would come over, and he'd say, well, you know, it'd be nice if you weren't here this evening or something mm-hmm. like that. But, it was.
Did you, and this is a focus on the Boy Scouts.
I mean, I mention this because, you know, there's been a lot of publicity recently
right.
about it.
I only made it to, I think, Life. I'd never made it to Eagle.
But, yeah, that's the one just before.
Right. I grew up, I was raised Catholic, but I wasn't exactly religious. Though I do remember from my time at Boy Scout meetings and occasionally going to Boy Scout camp that religion, at least in the form of prayer, was present before a meal or doing this, doing that. Did the religious aspect of the organization exist at the time that you were going through it? And if it did, did that play any complication for you?
It did. I mean, there were sort of prayer before, but I just didn't participate in the prayers, and I didn't do anything ostentatious to say, look, get up or something like that. But it certainly was there, and. But I did talk to my parents about it, and I said, look, I mean, this has nothing to do with me, and so I just didn't, and nobody said, well, you must, you know, say the prayers before you can eat or anything like that. It was just a fairly low level. And also, you know, about the Pledge of Allegiance, which, you know, at a certain stage, under God was added to
right.
it, and again, it was we often said that at the beginning of class, I guess nowadays it's probably not allowed to be said in most schools, but again, I just would not say it, and so I didn't make a big issue out of it, but I just personally, I sort of was satisfied with the fact that I was not violating. And it's not because of Judaism, it was just because I really didn't, wasn't religious and still am not religious. So sometimes, for instance, this has come up, I do tell people, I mean, when it's sort of, people ask me, do I believe in God or something? And I say, no, but as a scientist, you know, I do have a faith. I have a faith that the earth, that the world can be understood. There's no proof for this, but that's certainly a faith just as much as being religious.
Yeah. I'm wondering, the transition from the apartment in Boston and Brighton to Newton, where you began junior high, and I assume Bob was stepping into high school around then.
Right, he was going to, was already in Boston Latin School, where he'd been, I think, for a year, and then when we moved to Newton, he went to Newton High School, yeah.
What was the impetus for the move to Newton? Why
the
why
school,
leave?
The school.
It was for the school, for
it
you
was
and
the school
for Robert.
For me, no, I don't know whether my, I guess I don't know why, well, it was a junior high school, and I'm just trying to think about when my brother started Boston Latin. Well, he started very early, so maybe he went very quickly to Boston Latin, but it was when I was going to go to junior high school that my parents felt moving to Newton was a good thing to do. It was really, that was essentially for the schools. Yeah.
What was your memory of that school, that transition for you, well, being at the new junior high?
Well, actually, if we can just back up slightly,
yeah.
Given that you did go to school in Austria for a few years, you spent a little bit of time at a school in Zurich, and then you came to the United States. Did you have any, or do you have any reflections on the nature of the different school systems? Based on my understanding, I think Austria was Austria on the traditional gymnasium sort of.
Yeah, but okay. I wasn't there.
Right, right.
I was too young. It was just only the first and second grade.
Okay.
And started the third grade when I came here. And I mean, the one thing that was a difference, I believe, is that when I was in Austria, although I'm left-handed, I was forced to write with my right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came here and noticed the contortions that kids went through writing with their left hand, it was here, it was considered not that it was a bad thing to do, that you'd stutter and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I was very happy that I'd been forced to learn that. I was still so, and when I throw a ball, I basically throw it with the left hand,
mm-hmm.
and I'm somewhat ambidextrous. And when I hurt my wrist here, I wrote with my right hand, but never wrote really good, was very proficient with it. But that was sort of one difference in terms of the rigidity of the school system. Just you had to write with your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And, so, but otherwise, I was really too young to have any feeling about it. And we had as I mentioned, this very nice teacher, Herr Schreik, and when we were going through things for the film, we visited the school and they were able to look up about how he had taught here, and then there was some reason given why he left. Now, he was forced to leave, but they still had some record of it and such. But I mention him because, when I came here, as I wrote, I had this very wonderful teacher on whom I had a crush, and she kept me after school to help me learn English. And then, but unfortunately, I learned too quickly. So she said, there's no point in you getting any special lessons. And so in a way, I had this warm feeling when I started school here, as I did with the teachers in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And
So you mentioned that your parents wanted to move to Newton because of the schools. Do you have a sense of what they thought was lacking in the school that you were at, that they wanted you to be out in a school in Newton?
Well, I would have to go to a new school. That's in grade school, or grammar, what it's called, and then it was time for me to go to junior high school. And I don't know in detail, you know, what they thought was, but it was clear. I mean, Newton had, and I guess still has, the reputation of having very good schools, and I think that was sort of it. You know, parents now, nowadays, in Lexington or Newton or somewhere, you know, even though, you know, the Cambridge schools have improved a lot over the years.
What was that new school like for you?
Well, it was, you know, as again, I wrote this, it was a special experience that the teacher very quickly discovered that, you know, that I could do a lot more than the regular curriculum, and so they let me and Martha Palmer, who I also had a crush on for a while. And,
it's a good motivating factor, isn't it?
work together on our own and just take the exams when we had to take the important exams and such, and they would help us, but you know, we could learn a lot more. So it was really, I mean, that was one of the great things about the school, that they actually did that. And of course, the other thing was that we had to take some sort of manual training type thing, and what I did was one was printing, which I played with for a while afterwards, and the other was cooking. And I've always been very interested in food, and used to watch Mitzi, you know, cooking for me in Vienna, and then in the kitchen with my mother and grandmother when we were here. And I mean, what happened with my grandmother, who came over, and you know, we gave her the affidavit, and she would basically spend one third of the year with us, one third of the year in New York, and one third of the year with Claire, I mean, the three daughters who were in the U.S. And she used to try, she was somewhat of an invalid. I mean, she mainly had to be in a, she had had a fall and it hadn't been corrected in a completely successful way, but she always was around the kitchen. She always wanted to help, and so, you know, we'd be sitting in the kitchen peeling things and helping my mother. So I'd always been interested in cooking, which has developed over the years, which is another whole story of, but anyway, so I took cooking class, and it is true that I was the only boy in the class, but it was really, I mean, it was good. And you know, then we had to, at the end of the year, the exam was to prepare a dinner for a bunch of teachers and the other children in this class, that, you know, in the whole school of that grade and such. And and I don't know how much you wanted me to talk about my cooking experiences here.
I mean, as much as you want to, but I'm also curious, when you say printing, are you talking about printing press? Are you talking
about...
Yeah,
we had they're called, the letters, and put them into these lines, and then there was a printing press, and we would print out things, either, I mean, we could take something that we had to write for another class and actually print it up and such. So it was, you know, it was a old-fashioned printing press with letters that you pulled out of where they were, the A's, B's, and C's, and put them together in there, and put them into some sort of, I don't know all the words for this, for a holder that held them when you put them in the press. No, it was really
Because I wasn't sure. I know later you developed an interest in photography, so I wasn't right. sure if it may have been like photographic printing. So I just wanted to
to check. No, it was real printing.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. With the move to Newton, more of a suburb in Boston, or even just being in the United States itself, I'm wondering, this is in the early 1940s, with the war going on across in Europe, what was the experience of what was processing in Europe at this time? Was that something that was kept in front of you, or was that something that was in the distance then? How did the war play into your experience and memories at this time?
Well, I mean, we did talk about it, and we were obviously, my parents were very concerned about it, and I mean, they didn't sort of talk so much to me or my brother, but when we would get together, with other families, and some of these families, had not been as lucky as our family in terms of almost everybody getting out. I mean, it was clear that there was a concern of what was going on, and of course, the U.S., had then gotten into the war, and there was this one experience I had we're now at the stage where my microscope had been put aside, and I was very much interested in birds and bird watching, which was again an observational thing, like looking through the microscope, which I think I've always had, and it's also played out in the photography that I did. I was always interested in nature around me, and then thanks to my friend Alan McAdams from high school, he had noticed, I don't know quite why, the Lowell lectures. There was one on birds given by Ludwig Griscom, who was a professor here.
Here at Harvard.
Here at Harvard. He was a professor of ornithology here, and he was sort of the leading field ornithologist in the area. I mean, it's Roger Torrey Peterson who wrote these field guides and such, which basically was a complete transformation from sort of going out and watching birds, the idea being that rather than looking at pretty pictures of them like Audubon and such, you would try to know for each bird what they call the field marks, what you had to see to say that it was this bird rather than the other bird. And so he wrote this field guide, which was really a revolution in that. And Griscom was one of the people, not that he had anything to do directly with Peterson, but who had personally, developed this way of being able to identify the birds. And one time, when I was into bird watching, which we can talk more or less later on, but there was a snowstorm, and so there was no school. And so I took a train up to Gloucester or Rockport, I don't remember which, I think it's Gloucester, and I had done this, before with going out on field hikes, but I just went by myself, because I knew with the storm it was very likely, it was a nor'easter, that some of the seabirds, which are normally way out to sea, would come close to the shore. And so I went to a place where we usually went and sat there, with my binoculars looking out to sea. And indeed I did see several birds, but then after I'd been there for a while, a car drove up and a couple of people come out, and I thought first they were birders, who had come like me, except in car rather than by train. And they but they didn't really look like birders. I mean, they didn't have field glasses, which was the characteristics. And then all of a sudden, I realized they showed me their badges, that they were from the local police, and wondered what I was doing. And at that time, I guess I did have somewhat of an accent, and they asked me where it was from and everything, and it was at a time when there was danger of submarines off the coast, and so they thought that was signaling or something or other. I was 14. And obviously was very scared. And so they brought me down to the police station. And, well, it took a couple of hours of their telephoning to the Audubon Society and various people, you know, that I had interactions with, till they finally let me go.
So at that point, you had already had these interactions with the Audubon Society, enough that they could vouch and say,
"That's right.
Oh, Martin, of course, he's been on several of our trips." Tell us a little bit about how these Lowell lectures you mentioned that Ludlow Griscom was delivering. Tell us about that path into birdwatching, if you could.
Well, it was, I mean, as I said, it was Alan who had sort of said, why don't we go down there to visit the Boston Public Library? They had them regularly. I don't know whether they still have them. I meant to look it up. So I was fascinated by Ludlow's lecture. Alan actually just came to the first one and then stopped going. And then I think there are 8 lectures or something like that. And by, I don't know, the 3rd or 4th one, Griscom had noticed me, that there was this boy, you know, listening. And so, well, he asked me about my interest in birds and such, and then basically invited me to go on some bird hikes with him.
And how old were you around that time?
Well, I must have been, was in high school, I must have been, 15 probably, yeah, something like that. And also he introduced me to the Brooklyn Bird Club, which was, I'm not sure whether he introduced me or whether I actually found it myself, because I started going to the Mount Auburn Cemetery. I think he introduced me and also to some of the people at the Audubon Society that I, you know, got to be very close to. And, and I was always the youngest, you know, which has sort of been a theme of my life, that I've been the youngest and, the Eagle Scout and so on. And it's sort of funny for me to realize now that I'm the oldest in all of these things. But anyway, so, you know, he invited me to go along with them, and then I met the people from the, you know, there were other people who went on these bird hikes with him who were all very good birders, and I had actually the binoculars from my father that he had had. I think he had had them when he was in the army in the First World War, which he wasn't very long. I don't know whether it's another story, but he was actually in the cavalry on the Austrian side. Very early on, he dropped his pistol and hit his little finger, and then and some people thought, well, he must have done this on purpose. Mm-hmm. But I think it's pretty hard to drop this
and shoot yourself in the pinky. Yeah,
and so he was demobilized because he could no longer ride very well, and so he got out of the army. Mm-hmm. So he had these binoculars which he then let me use, and I still have them. And I have other binoculars now, because although they're quite powerful, they would take a lot of work to readjust them. I dropped them once, so it was that way that when with Griscom he introduced me to people at the Audubon Society. And
what was it about the birding and the lectures that drew you in?
Well, it just seemed so exciting that when it was, a little bit, with the research aspect that he presented of trying to understand why, birds live in different habitats, how the number goes up and down and such, that and also this observational part, which, as I said, has always been part of my life, was exciting to me. And so that's all the free time after that that I had when I was in high school. I spent either going on trips with groups or like this business of going to the North Shore by myself. I would do that. And what nowadays, I don't really go out on bird hikes anymore. I mean, still, aware of birds, and when we're in the countryside, I usually take my binoculars with me and watch. And I have, like, for example, one of my former postdocs who was in Houston invited me to come down there, and I said sure I would come if it's known that the wintering area of Whistling I don't know whether it's the Whistling Swamps or it's one of the I'm not quite sure what the bird is. I would have that if he would take me out, there was a place where in winter, they summer in Canada, and the winter they come down there and you can see them. I guess it's some sort of a stork, but that's I forget what it was. But anyway, so I said, I'd come if you'd do that. And we went out on this in a boat, that goes sort of around the area, and it was a great trip. And he got interested in birds after that.
You mentioned earlier that at least in your mother's family, it seemed to be kind of a tradition that someone would become a physician. I know that you were doing well in school, you were excelling in school. How did your parents respond to your interest in birds and ornithology? I haven't heard you talking much about whether or not your family has been influencing you or pushing you in any directions in terms of the career that you would want to pursue. And so I was kind of curious what was going on at home with relation to your studies and things like that.
Well, it was both in my brother's case and my case, it was just supportive.
Okay.
I think they were very happy that, we were interested in science, probably rather than in business or something like that, that it was an intellectual activity which was, part of the family, as you've heard, and it was always supportive. And I would tell them to talk to them about my field trips and such, and it was always supportive. It was not sort of saying, well, you're supposed to be the doctor.
Okay.
Actually, my two daughters are both doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we skipped a generation. And then one of my cousins, he became a doctor, even though he had my aunt, Lena, sister of my mother, mentioned before, who was a doctor. And they had these two children, Gus, who was a year older than my brother, and George, who was a year younger than me. And George actually became a psychiatrist. And so there did somebody in this generation, even though I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really saying, well, you should be a doctor. And, I expected to be a doctor until really I went to Harvard as an undergraduate, where I first sort of realized that I was more interested in understanding how things work than actually being a physician.
Hmm.
Was your brother Robert also interested in the birding and the ornithology?
Not at all.
That was a track that you took on your own.
Yeah.
What was it like with your brother in school? Did you attend the same high school together?
We attended the same high school, and there's, of course, a whole story about that. But, you know, in junior high school, as I mentioned, you know, again, I was treated as very supportive, allowed to do what I wanted to do if it meant that I, you know, my studies were going along. When I went to high school, it was very different, that my brother... That was the first time, I guess, that my brother had actually preceded me in the same school. And he, you know, was very bright. And so basically I was considered the little brother who was not as bright as my older brother. And so it was not, no, in many cases, you know, it really didn't come up in history or whatever, but it was in science in particular, in chemistry even more so, that the chemistry teacher, I did fine, you know, it wasn't that I didn't do well, but constantly reminded me, you know, oh, we had your brother, and the specific thing that was, you know, sort of most important was this Westinghouse Science Talent Search, where my brother actually encouraged me to apply. He hadn't, I don't know, I think it had existed already, but he said, well, your brother should have applied, and, you know, there's no point in your applying, and he didn't, even, you know, he would have been the person who should have, you know, since that was a science I was taking in that year, you know, it was biology, chemistry, and physics, sort of, first, second, and so I guess with the encouragement of a brother, I took to the principal, who said, you know, that if I wanted to do this, you know, he would, you know, help me do this. And the main thing really was to get a proctor. I mean, you had to take a test, and to take a proctor, get a proctor who would proctor me on the test and fill in the forms and such. So everything did get done, and I was one of the 40 people who were selected to go down to Washington for the finals, and then finally actually was the co-winner. In those days, there was one boy and one girl who won. Nowadays, I don't think it's sex related. And
what was your project? What was your project?
The project was actually on birds and some of the else. And you know, if we get down to here's picture of me showing this bird, which was it was on one of the field trips in Newburyport with Ludlow Griscom. He spied a bird that he couldn't recognize what it was, and so he had a license. He had sort of a pistol with a very long war, so he could aim it like a rifle. And so he asked me to go out and collect the bird, as one says. And I didn't have a license, of course, but I had to go sort of through the mud. It was sitting out there in the mud flats, which are uncovered, you know, when the tide goes out. And I never shot a, maybe I did at some country fair, but I no idea, but I did manage to hit it, and we collected it. And then he decided that it was a hybrid between two different gulls, one that lives in the U.S., the Bonaparte gull, and one that's very common here, and one that's very common in Europe, the black-headed gull, and one of them must have come over, and this was their offspring. And one of the things, well, it was here in the, you know, in the Peabody Museum for a long time, and then it was given
to the museum in Essex County, which has a large collection of local birds and such. And we visited it actually one day and found it. And then I brought back a couple of feathers, because there was a project of involving gulls and other birds that get caught in the jet stream and sometimes affect the jet engines. And so they were interested in finding out, and these birds, of course, completely destroyed when they're in there. So they want to be able to identify the birds. And so there was essentially a barcode research project so they could identify birds. And there was a new professor here at the time when I wrote this who was interested in genetics, and then somebody else to actually take these feathers and find out whether what we had guessed from their field marks was actually correct, but they never did it.
That was Scott Edwards and...
Right, yeah.
But they never sequenced the DNA?
I never could get them to do it. I don't know exactly why, but it just never... I mean, they had gotten the feathers from the museum. It permitted me to take a couple of them. You don't need very much, but... And I tried until fairly recently, and then I may still have some email exchanges. There was a woman who was doing some of this, but it never, so we'll never know, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it earned you a trip to Washington, D.C. in the mid-40s.
Right. I mean, it was more about the Massachusetts alcids, like the little auk, which I was looking for, and describing their migration and such. But I don't know. And it's actually the 65th anniversary of this Westinghouse. So it's no longer Westinghouse. It's Intel now supported. But then they're so... And this spring they're inviting people down, all the Nobel Prize winners that have come through there and having a symposium about different things. And I mean, I decided I would go, and I think the reason I want to go is, that it played a very important role in my life, particularly, as I mentioned, in terms of my comparison with my brother and everything, that I won this. And
did you ever have any interactions with that chemistry professor after having the Westinghouse experience?
No. I mean, I still have a clear picture of his face. He was sort of partly bald and around. But no, and he never said, oh, congratulations, or anything like that. So,
have you been to Washington, D.C. before?
Have I been to Washington? I think the answer is no.
So you had gone there just around the time that the war had ended.
Right. It was when Truman was president, and we met Truman.
What was that experience like?
Well, it was a great experience. Somewhere I have a photograph of us, all of us standing with Truman. And when I won the Nobel Prize, Obama... I don't know what the other presidents, I presume, so invite all the American Nobel Prize winners down to Washington and then to meet him. And I don't know whether, well, we have a very nice picture of Marcy and me with Obama. But before going down there, I was invited, and before going down there, I sort of said to Marcy, if it's just going to be a photo op, I don't think it's worth going. And but I knew the science advisor and sort of talked with him about it. And he said, well, really, when the president invites you, you don't refuse unless either you're deathly sick or there's somebody in the family who has a funeral. And then I asked him, well, what will happen? He said, well, it's really up to you. you know, he's the president and he can do what he wants. And so, you know, we were down there, and again, there's a whole story, but when we were in the Oval Office, because of the way things, I mean, there was the prize in chemistry, in physiology, in medicine, and in economics, and in that order. And so we all, and my name in the chemistry prize is first in the alphabet, so I'm always it's Karplus, Leavitt, and Warshall, and so I was the first one in there, and I actually had my photo catalog with me with a dedication to him. And so, well, first I said to him, well, you know, that you're the second president that I've met. And he said, yes. And I said, well, I met Harry Truman, and he was the first president to try to get the universal health care, though it didn't succeed. And so Obama stopped. I don't know what your politics are, but Obama sort of stopped and thought for a little bit. He said, no, that's not true. It was Theodore Roosevelt. And then he thought again and said, well, Theodore Roosevelt did propose it, but that was when he was campaigning for his office, and he wasn't elected. So he agreed that Truman was, and I said, well, so anyway. And then I gave him the photo book, and he looked at it a little bit. And when I met President Hollande of France, where they celebrated me, he came actually to Strasbourg partly to see me and partly to give a speech, sort of use this as a setting to give a speech about science and how well France was doing. That so each country, once you get a Nobel Prize, the U.S., France, and Austria all
want to claim you.
Want a little piece. But he came, and we chatted with him, and on a personal level, he was very engaging. And so I also gave him a photo book, and I said to him, I know you're going to see President Obama in 2 weeks or something, so ask him whether he's looked at my book. Yeah? Anyway, well.
So another thing I'm curious about is, you know, given the time period we're talking about, this is also when the atomic bomb is first used. Were there any, do you recall any responses or reactions, either in your household in terms of politics and thoughts about the use of the bomb, or in school in response to this new military weapon coming out, the scientific advance? Was anyone talking about it at the time?
Well.
And were you interested in it?
Yeah, no, I was always very interested in politics, and it was clearly, I mean, this big question was, you know, when, and that was also with Truman, you know, actually, that whether dropping the second bomb was a valid thing to do, whether or not that was, well, there are two questions which we discussed, with friends and such. One, whether dropping the bomb in the middle of the ocean or something would have been enough, we didn't have to kill all these people. And secondly, whether, you know, dropping the second bomb was necessary after the first. I mean, that was sort of what was going on. Also, we knew that something was going on. We didn't know exactly what it was, because a cousin, a relative, Robert Frisch, who had worked with Lisa Meitner on first showing the possibility of chain reactions, she never got a Nobel Prize, which is something, another story. But anyway, Robert Frisch used to, who was a good friend of my parents and also related, and would come and visit us. That was the time when the atomic bomb was being made in Los Alamos, and he would sort of come, and then he said, "Well, I can't tell you what's going on," and then he would disappear, and then he would come back again, there were things in the air about what was going on at the time, he was involved in it. So I don't know whether that's sort of...
Yeah, I was just curious if you recall anything specific about, you know, the use of the bomb or discussion.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly was a real question. And the explanation that's given why this was dropped, first of all, on some city where it had really an effect, and secondly, why two were dropped, is that originally they weren't really sure that it would work at all. I mean, that's all they had was two bombs, and so if that didn't work, then they didn't have anything else to do it. And I don't know whether the argument has still been resolved. And I, you know, did meet Robert Oppenheimer, who had been, you know, sort of running the project essentially in Los Alamos when he was the head of the Institute of Advanced Studies, where my brother went as a postdoctoral fellow after being here at Harvard.
So you also went to Harvard after your brother had gone there.
Right.
And I'm wondering about that transition as well. But before we step into that, perhaps you could tell us a little bit back to the birding, because I also understand there was a really unique opportunity to go to Alaska.
That's right.
Before it had become a state, but was part of the American territory, of course.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about how that happened? Who was involved? How did that come across your experience?
Well, I had heard that Robert Galambos, who was working in the lab in the basement of Memorial Hall, was interested in bats, and so I'd gone to see him.
Memorial Hall, the giant cathedral-looking building.
Yeah, I guess it doesn't mean anything. I just say Memorial Hall. I mean, everybody here would.
Yeah.
And they had a basement where there were some laboratories. I think they're now a cafeteria or something. But he had, with Robert Griffin, discovered the echolocation that bats use to find, you know, when they're flying around. Like radar, they bounce it off insects, and they can tell how far away, by how long it takes, how far away they are. And they're pretty much blind, you know, and they live in dark caves and everything. And so that's how they find the insects. And he had, although somebody long ago had some ideas about that, he did really careful experiments on that with Donald Griffin, who was at Cornell. And then I don't remember exactly why I went to that. I'd read about this and was interested in it, and went to see him. And then I talked to him about my interest in birds. So he said that Don Griffin was actually professor of ornithology at Cornell, and sort of wrote me an introduction. And then Griffin invited me to come to Cornell for a summer and work with him on experiments, and we worked on pigeons. That was my main project, but I also worked a little bit on bats. And the sort of the one nice thing about bats was, since they're cold-blooded, you can just put them in the refrigerator and they'll just, you know, hang there the way bats do, and then when you want to do an experiment, you just take one out,
pluck them out,
and warm it up. And I did some experiments on pigeons, which were interesting, but they didn't really lead anywhere. I mean, nothing publishable. Though actually, I haven't mentioned this, but my first papers were on birds, and one is actually was. But it has to do with Alaska, so I'll
get through that. And so then he invited me to go up to Alaska, where they were going to...
Donald Griffin did.
Griffin did, right, yeah. Columbus is sort of faded from the picture. And basically the idea is to study bird migration and how birds find their way. And one of the experiments that we were interested in doing was to, there are two types of golden plovers, the Atlantic and Pacific one, but they nest together in Alaska, and then one of them flies down, and in the fall you can see them flying here. I mean, many of them go out birding, and the Pacific ones go in the other direction. And so we tried various experiments to capture the plovers and then attach little magnets to them and release them and see sort of how they would fly around and whether they could find their way back from, we would take them away. And well, that's sort of the short part of it. But
how did you attach a magnet to these little plovers?
Well, it's hard, but you know, it's attached to the wings right close in. It's not really on their heads, and I don't know how good the experiment was, but the results weren't really conclusive. But I mean, the reason we were able to go to Alaska was because there was an Arctic research laboratory, which was just generally it was funded by the Navy and to study, you know, how people would live and the conditions there. And did all kinds of research. I mean, the Navy, I don't know whether you know this, but after the war was really the first government agency to support fundamental science. And many people, you know, who had their first grants, you know, from the ONR, which was very important in science funding before there was a National Science Foundation or NIH or anything like that. And so there was this laboratory there where you could easily work and live there and such. But we also went to a small place called Umiat, where there was a hut where we also, I can't really remember, I think we were trying to look at some of the plovers that were not nesting very close, but then it was sort of inland on the tundra. But I had the idea of doing a study of robins, you know, which are very common down here, but they also occur in Alaska, the same robins that are here. And the question I asked was, what is the survival value of robins that come to Alaska and go through this horrendous flight to get there? And so the hypothesis was, well, we have continuous daylight, or essentially continuous daylight, and so the robins would be able to feed their young over a 16 or 18 hour period rather than what happens around here. And the most, where they're most exposed to be caught by other predators as such was when they were in the nest. And so I don't know quite how I had all this idea, but anyway, so I thought maybe they would be grow up faster because they were being fed more. And I was there with a couple of other older people like always, and got them to work with me to take sort of 8-hour shifts and watch for a couple of weeks the nesting birds and see what would happen. We had enough nests around there, so we got the data which suggested yes, they in fact did grow up faster. And so I published the paper on that I think in 19, I don't know when it was published. I guess I know.
Were you still in high school, or was this after you?
this was when I was in college. Mm. Yeah, that's when I met Columbus and everything. This was all,
oh, is that after you were at Harvard that you, and then right. got connected with Donald Griffin?
Yeah, no, it was that I was at Harvard, so it was easy to go over there. Mm. And let's see, it was in 1952 that it was published. Bird Activity in the Continuous Daylight of Arctic Summer. And the amusing thing is, it's there's still a controversy whether this result is actually correct or not. And it's still cited. If you look it up in sci-fi, there's still articles, I don't know, now maybe it's one or two a year, where they discuss that. So
that's wonderful. What was the experience of getting to Alaska like, either from Ithaca or Boston or wherever you went, all the way to the Arctic, across
right.
the
continent? Right, so it was... I first flew to Alberta, and then from Alberta up to Fairbanks, and then from Fairbanks a little plane up to Point Barrow, which had an airfield. And that was also, and I stopped off in Alberta to meet with somebody named Rowan, who was the first person to realize that when birds, you know, why do they lay nests spring or summer? And what he did was to keep birds, you know, under continuous daylight or short daylight, whether daylight didn't change, I guess, whether daylight didn't change, and then studied what happened to their gonads. And he found that they developed only if the daylight increased, so that sort of
how the cycle.
Yeah, so he kept them in cages and watched them, and so I stopped off to visit him because I'd seen that, and I also discovered in his basement he had this unbelievable model railroad, which he liked to play with, and so I spent a few days there, and then flew up to Fairbanks and. Which was a pretty rough town in those days.
And
what I remember is that it had a church, which had a direct entrance to a saloon. So
from the church.
After going to church. And, it was all, it was an exciting experience. And then from there I went to Barrow and did these things. Yeah.
And all this air travel?
It was all air travel. It was actually, it was called, what is now Alaska Airlines, was called Ween Airlines. And amidst the Ween had two airplanes, and she flew from not getting to Alberta, but from to fly up to Point Barrow. And that it's now Alaska Airlines, which now is all over the country, yes. I guess. Yeah.
I'm wondering, what was this relationship you had like with all of these more senior researchers as this very young man, 18 or 17 perhaps?
Yeah.
My notes show that, in fact, did you finish high school in 3 years?
I finished college in 3 years. Hmm. High school, I think I went... I'm not sure.
Yeah, it seems like you moved rapidly through any schooling you had.
Yeah.
So here's this young man coming to Alaska to do bird research at the tip north end of the continent.
Yeah.
What was that experience like, and how were you treated, and what was the social environment?
Well, of course, I learned to drink coffee, which I never liked before, but everybody drank coffee, and of course and we were keeping weird hours and such. But I really only interacted very much with, the people with Griffin and the other people that I was with. And I don't know, I don't remember any, and there were a cafeteria and such, and so we would see the people. And
But even the people on Griffin's team, were they also older than you?
Yeah, I mean, there's no. As I said, I was always the youngest in almost everything that I did, and they, they were sort of
I mean, they treated me like an equal in some ways. And actually, I have them here. And one of the other things I did, there were the Eskimos living there. And
these are Kodachromes.
Yeah, these are old. Here are some of the polar bears.
Wow.
And here's an Eskimo woman chopping up a polar bear.
Wow.
It's gorgeous.
Are these polar bears pets? Looks like they're wearing collars.
Huh?
It looks like they're wearing collars. Oh, wow.
Here's one of the boat that they're going out, I guess, to catch seals. I guess it's, yeah.
And so these are photographs you took?
Yeah.
I thought that photography for you started after graduate school. Was this something that then you were doing earlier than?
Well, I was trying to... Yeah, I didn't do anything really after that for a while. But then here are the baby.
Oh, wow.
That woman chopping the polar bear meat, looks like she and her baby are sitting on she's chopping the meat and the child is sitting on a dog sled.
Yeah,
in the summer.
Yeah, there's a...
Out of wood.
No, they're actually...
Oh, these are the golden... These are the golden plovers that you went to see.
Yeah. Babies, yeah.
Captured in a hat.
Yeah, I haven't looked at them actually for a long time. And there are a couple of women.
Now, these photographs of people that are living in places that seem so foreign to you, to your experience in the suburbs or in cities, is something you've continued.
Right,
is that right?
Right, yeah. Though it's... I hadn't really associated with them, you know, with my later interest in photography, which
these are beautifully framed shots.
Yeah. Are any of these in your photo book?
No. I've actually never done anything with them. Now that I look at them, they look pretty good.
Yeah, you
they look very good.
A new exhibition here.
Yeah. Maybe I should. I mean. Actually working on an exhibition from the meeting in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
Where,
along the same lines with Roger's questioning, I remember my experiences in high school in the science classes that we had, and I remember my experiences in college in the science classes that we had. And I don't think at any point did I learn how to be a colleague with someone who was practicing science for a living. How is it that you felt comfortable or became knowledgeable enough to interact with these scientists at what seems to be a more advanced level when you were still learning how to become a scientist? I mean, were you going out and reading scientific journals on your own? Were you doing experiments outside of lab that were beyond what was required?
Not really. I mean, certainly in writing this article about the robins, I looked at the literature to see. Of course, it was much harder to look at the literature then. You didn't just put robins, Alaska. And there it is. I guess I should look with it. Mm. I haven't looked recently. No, I don't. I don't really know. No, I've always been very quick.
Okay.
And I think people recognize this, and you know, I think in all these things, you know, like the fact that I was able to get these two people to work with me to watch the robins. I mean, I don't know, I can't really tell you where they just sort of think, oh, it's nice that this kid is doing that, or what it was that made them accept to do this with me. It's true, there wasn't that much to do where we were. I mean, there, I mean, the other interesting thing that happened is that, and again, sort of, I realized this and then told it to them that, though they observed the same thing, that, of course, we had, you know, nothing that, basically, we had continuous daylight, and so we had no, when we were at Point Barrow, obviously, our schedule was determined by when we had dinner at, you know, in the cafeteria and such, or whatever, breakfast. And, but there we had nothing to determine our schedule. And it turned out that, you know, we did our own cooking, that basically we ended up having an 18-hour day and then a 12-hour night cycle. It's, and I don't know, I've never looked this up, but I remember this, that sort of, other when this a person was busy watching the robins or something like that, that's sort of what we ended up doing, because we I guess we sort of slowly shifted. And
they're altering space and time, I
And whether that, whether people now have, they probably have studied this in more detail. I thought I should look it up, but I never looked it up. But I think they were sort of, you know, I guess, and I mentioned this to them, and they said, oh, yeah. But, you know, but I guess it's always been that I've had this sort of ability to find something, you know, like my father did, and sort of, and,
We're going to stop for just a minute, and then I actually want to, I think something we skipped over was hearing about why you wanted to go to, or how you wound up going to Harvard for your undergraduate degree. So let me just turn this off and then...
Okay.